Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
Gentlemen, do you know what today is?
Pi Day!
Pi Day?
Oh,
also,
the Ides of March!
True.
Isn't that tomorrow?
Wait, is it the 15th? I have no idea.
Is it the 2-year anniversary of ChatGPT-4?
Or GPT-4, yes. The 2-year anniversary of the launch of GPT-4.
Which of course would have been on Pi Day. Yeah, that tracks.
Which it's crazy because so for the launch. I worked on the launch with Joanna Jang, who was the product manager for GPT-4. So I handled like the producing the videos, the you go to the webpage for GPT-4 and all that. That's why you'll see my name in the examples and stuff. And so, you know, it was a lot of like, hey, what are some fun things it can do? Let's figure out how to tell people what it can do. It's crazy for me because somebody just retweeted the video, which I produced. And it's just crazy to think that was 2 years ago, because it feels like 5 in many respects, in kind of like there are decades in my life that feel like, you know, 3 weeks. And then there are weeks in my life that feel like years.
I'll tell you what, that is one of those things that subjectively, and we'll talk about this more in After Things where we talk about being an independent creator, but there are, it seems like habit and routine is a double-edged sword in that it's the best way to, you know, better yourself or make progress financially with your health or education, you name it. However, it is a time warp where doing the same thing, you know, it seems like a year goes by with nothing. That's part of why I got so addicted to being on the road was it was a lifetime every single day, you know, a new city, new people. You've got to be best friends for exactly 7 hours, do the gig, go to bed, hit a new town.
I'm excited about the future, but looking at how fast time flies, that also makes me think that, like, you know, the podcast, you know, we record around Alpha Centauri may not be that crazy of a thing to think about. But
I actually do have a little bit of frontline news on the AI front. I met with a company. There's a couple of companies that I met with that do AI search for insane amounts of back catalog material. And one of the examples I brought up is we've brought up over the 15, 17 years that we've been doing this, a ton of speculation about what we would see in the future. So many predictions. And now, because I still have all of that data, all neatly archived and stuff, we're going to be able to search, expect sometime in 2025, we're going to be able to find out all the predictions we've ever made that have turned out to be true from like 15 years ago. And it'll go jump straight to those exact clips. It's extraordinary.
I'm also curious to think about what were the big things we missed that not even predicted. We never even was even on our radar.
Yeah.
Any, what would be, I mean, well, one, GPT-4 was, I would say that's a thing everybody's really dealing with now is how much that part of the future got pulled into the present.
Oh yeah. I mean, the hockey stick growth of LLMs was not something that people saw coming. There were a lot of next big things that kind of rolled through and machine learning and stuff like that, which was always certainly a healthy part of the academic field. And, you know, in certain areas, probably more a part of our average experience than some people would have thought beforehand. But like GPT-3, obviously, for people who paid attention, knew that this was a big step forward. And then 4, I think made people realize like, oh, wait, we're on a really, really, really exciting drumbeat. That this stuff is getting exponentially better. And that's really set the intervening 2 years where you have OpenAI go from a interesting company to a pretty dominant a company in the world of technology is a great example.
Yeah, it is. We because the joke now is like, you know, every week just there's something new. and in the directions things are going to. And, you know, if we look at deep research, just being not that old, but already, like I mentioned before on another show, like my mom's talking about how she uses deep research.
Yeah. What does your mom use it for? What is your mom's use case?
She's genealogy.
Huh.
Yeah, I guess that she's been using it for genealogy and researching like backgrounds and stuff. So for her, you know, presents these really neat reports for her on that, which is just, it's just, you know, neat when, you know, you're watching, you know, your 80-year-old parent, you know, who's using the tool and the eagerness, you know, to just embrace new stuff. And it was just super cool. So
I've been using it a lot. I've been using deep research. It's probably the AI thing that I use the most.
I don't even know how much of my affection for deep research is simply, maybe it's a placebo effect of the fact that it immediately pushes back and says, well, what do you really want to know? Like, I know that's an important clarifying step, but I know that even if it's just, I'm fooling myself, that I perceive it as really trying to understand the full story, but the reports that it comes back with are fantastic.
So I had a story that I wanted to talk about here on OpenAI, which we can talk about. And then I said, you know, I'm going to run this through deep research because I'm very curious, because it's one of these things where in a lot of fringe sort of stuff, you often don't get a lot of good scholarship. And so I'm talking about the Ramree massacre.
The what?
Picture this. It's World War II, February 1945. Ramree Island off the coast of Burma, now known as Myanmar. Hundreds of Japanese soldiers have been fought back by Allied forces and pushed into the jungle. And the story goes, they heard the sound of screams because the mangroves were infested with crocodiles. As many 1,000 Japanese troops entered and only a few dozen survived. Guinness Book of Records describes that the most human fatalities in a crocodile attack with an estimated 900 casualties.
Well, that sounds like a credible report of a horrific massacre.
Yeah. So I read this, I saw this thing, it got mentioned. It's one of these things that kind of in like, you know, meme culture, whatever, the Ramree, where somebody, scholarship in that is like, hey, I read a blog and I'm going to write a video about this. Although the blog post was poorly informed or whatever. So I asked, you know, deep research. I'm like, hey, what's the story on this? And I gave it, told it to look up. It went in and did a deep dive into the stories, the accounts, the supporting evidence, back and forth, and who all the different, like the different players, you know, who the eyewitness reports were. Like, I'm getting the names of all the eyewitness people. Like, literally, you could turn this into a Nat Geo doc. Like, right now, I could just take this and format into a documentary, and I'd have a great friggin', you know, 20-minute doc on this topic. And basically, it says, you know, wildlife experts are like, listen, like, one, you know, crocodiles don't attack in court. I'm like, I agree, but I don't think that was really the claim. The claim was just there were just a lot of crocodiles there. But people were like, well, we don't think an island could support that many crocodiles. It's like, well, you don't need one crocodile per person. You know, I think one croc can take out a lot of people. But, you know, and then when they try to get more accounts of how many people may have actually been eaten by crocs and whatever. And it seems like a few people probably did get eaten by crocodiles, but it probably wasn't like 900 people got, you know, devoured by a coordinated attack.
That's a lot of people.
It wasn't like a tower defense game. I saw those ads where they just show tower defense games coming and there, you know, there's always gigantic battalions of folks going into a giant meat grinder. The one I saw had so many units of people. It was just particle physics. It just looked like liquid being cleaned up by a giant gun mop.
And to give you the level of scholarship involved that deep research did, one of the links I clicked on was Stephen Platt et al.'s 2001 investigation in the Herpetological Bulletin. And I click on it and it pops open a PDF of the Herpetological Bulletin for spring 2001 with a whole article about it. And I'm like, that's some deep research.
That's some deep research. Freeze frame.
It's just amazing because I'm looking at this going like, yeah, like when I'm trying to get to the bottom of something and it's like it's got diagrams and all sorts of other stuff of this, where the pathway is. And, you know, none of the blogs I've read about this have ever kind of got into like anywhere this sort of detail.
So where did it find the super detailed stuff?
It found a link somewhere and it found this PDF of a report.
But eventually it got in its hands. I mean, it basically did the real life job of a research assistant. It got an actual document, original source in its hands and looked at it and understood that this is probably what the human wants.
Yeah. It found a ton of stuff. This is weird. Okay. I got to read this to you. All right. Hold on. This took a strange turn.
Okay.
So what it did is, you know, as deep research goes through, it finds information, it finds links, it finds those links, it chases that down, it finds those sources, it reads those sources, really does. It doesn't just grab, doesn't do a keyword search and grab all the stuff. It literally reads it and says, oh, this is good. Let me go get this document. Oh, this is good. Let me get this. So I want to read something to you. So this was from the report. And, most convincingly, during a recent visit to Ramry Island, Platt, one of the authors of this, we interviewed a number of older residents who cast additional doubt on the magnitude of the alleged massacre. These individuals range from 67 to 86 years old and all lived on Ramry Island during World War II. Several had billeted Japanese soldiers in their homes and were conscripted as porters by the Japanese army. These individuals all related a similar version of events. The Japanese force retreated into the mangrove swamp and rapidly exhausted their food and water rations. Fresh water was unavailable, and the soldiers were forced to drink brackish water, resulting in severe dehydration. Dysentery and other diseases were rampant among the Japanese, and many succumbed to these privations. The only crocodile-related deaths occurred when 10 to 15 soldiers were killed attempting to ford Byanshan, a tidal creek near Ramry Town. Our informants unanimously discounted any suggestion that large numbers of Japanese fell prey to the crocodiles. Okay. He says they've spoken to, moreover, because I wanted to know what was the Japanese point of view on this. An informant in Kayakafu, who conducts regular tours for visiting Japanese veterans, stated his clients often recount their wartime experiences, but have never mentioned crocodile attacks. So they get in there. So anyhow, I read that, which is kind of cool. And it gets into like how the Japanese had this, the Bushido code and suicide code and with suicide is preferable and .. I just want to get to this. Acknowledgements. Fieldwork in Myanmar was funded by the Walt Disney Company Foundation.
What? That was a hard left turn.
It's just not the
from the trustworthy team that brought us the urban legend of lemmings running off a cliff.
I'm like, why is the Disney Company funding an investigation into? I mean, it's probably just broader, like a thing in doing like probably nature studies in Myanmar. But that was just, I'm like, wait, what? The Imagineers are like, hey, we're working on the Hu Bayou, you know, crocodile experience. And, you know, if you had a large number of people, I don't know, 1,000, and you pushed them through an area with crocodiles, what could go wrong?
Oh, man. But still, it's one of those things where it's like, it's all your expectations. If you go in thinking, okay, 900 people died of crocodile attacks and then find out that 15 people died of crocodile attacks, you're like, oh, boo. But then if you just told somebody 15 people died of crocodile attacks, you're like, what? This deserves a Netflix documentary tomorrow.
I'm sure we're going to get, you know, the movie anyhow.
Yeah. Too many teeth.
Too many teeth.
It's the problem where like, it's the hard part about making movies on actual events. As you hear about an event, you go, oh, that sounds amazing. Like, oh man, that sounds like an amazing movie. And like, I could do it from the point of view of an allied soldier along with some Japanese soldiers behind lines and the crocodiles and trying to survive. Like, let me research. It never happened. I'm like, oh, damn it.
Yeah.
900 people didn't die for me to have the story.
You know, as somebody who has to research and write scripts about real world events that you are trying to put in the most daring and exciting and narrative driven terms possible, boy, does it
is it really a kick in the teeth when you find out that history's playing defense against you and this really cool narrative that you have in your head now just does not work whatsoever at all.
It's inconvenient. Yeah.
Yeah. We actually had that with the Q Ships episode of World's Greatest Con, where we had just conflated at a certain point, two different people and combined them into one. And if you're telling like a movie story, there's like a little bit of leeway, especially if you go further back in history, but it's like, it didn't make sense for the way that we had the story going. And then all of a sudden we have to just be like, okay, well let's, and that was after we recorded, we had like a mixing and stuff done. And then I took another look at something and I'm like, okay, we need to do some re-records because this is not the same person that we have told this singular story
about. Well, and the funny thing was, I mean, luckily it wasn't as much of a disaster as it could have been. It was more like we had a bunch of facts correct, but our use of the word because needed to be rethought.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's like, well, very clearly this was not the motivation for the thing.
It was not. Yeah. These things that happened to this person did not therefore create the things that we were talking about afterward. They all happened in that sequential order. And it's still held together in terms of our larger thing, but yeah. Adaptation. It's weird because, you know, I think that, I don't know, Maine, what do you think about this? Like when you're adapting something that's real, is there more leeway the further back that you go? Like, or what are the hard lines that you would have in terms of trying to tell a story that is in the most dramatic and interesting and narrative way possible without, you know, sacrificing stuff that really either like hurts the real people involved or hurts the real story? Like how do you help it?
I'm the believer that actually people sometimes try to simplify because they want to avoid the complications, and I often think the complications are actually what makes it really interesting. For example, you get this in biopics all the time.
Yeah.
Where you'll find out, you know, there was, you know, kids involved, that like a couple has a thing, and then actually, you know, you find out like, wait a second, they had kids, there are three kids there, but you just wrote out the kids. I'm like, I get that that was a complication to have to talk about the kids, but that's makes the story more interesting. And, you know, yeah. And other examples like the Von Erich family was when they did the movie about them,
Iron Claw.
Iron Claw, like,
I don't know that story, I don't think.
So the Von Erichs were a super popular wrestling family out of Texas. And the father had several boys, and they met with, many of them met with very tragic ends, right? There's a lot of complicated things going on. And so, and they made a movie about it. I think it's a good movie, but the number of brothers was like, I want to say there were like five brothers, but then for the movie, they brought it down to like three, you know, and or four. Yeah. They basically got rid of a brother in the story. And I watched one of the producers, somebody say something to the effect like, well, he had a pretty much similar storyline to another brother. And I'm like, this is my whole thing. I told you before, people aren't real, the theory. And I'm like, these are not characters.
Yeah.
These are people. And you just said this person's identity isn't important because you thought they're very similar to the other brother. And that's the writer talking, but again, if you're a biographer, you need to go, no, I need to illustrate that might be part of the problem is these two brothers, they're all trying to fit in the same sort of mold. And you had two people who were maybe trying to find the same pattern. And I get that, like, I can get the justification for moving him bothered me. And I had trouble going to see the movie because I'm like, you just erased a person, like you're getting rid of a character on a page. And this was a living, breathing human being. And so my theory is that, like, the more we consume media from the same screen, that we watch Netflix and podcasts and news shows on tablets and phones that show us social media and everything else, the more people confuse real people for characters. Not overtly, but you've seen this.
I hadn't really thought about the modality in which we consume being a problem in terms of the upstairs intellectual hygiene. That's fascinating. I I don't know. I'm going to have to sit with that. That's awesome.
Yeah, you know, it's terrifying too, because like, you know, like I bring that up because like, you know, you have a guy, I won't bother naming him, who murders a father in New York City, you know, brutally murders somebody, cold-blooded kills him, and the killer becomes a celebrity with people. And I watched, you know, Jimmy Kimmel joke about how his producers are thirsting over the guy. And I'm like, this is not Game of Thrones. You know, there's a mother with kids who's crying herself to sleep at night because she's alone now. And there was the complete lack of compassion for thinking through that. Not only was this person real, the people around him are real, and the hurt that was caused there. And you know, you can hand wave like, well, you know, it's just a serious thing about healthcare. Like, that's a separate thing. Like, literally, somebody got murdered, you know, and people don't want to acknowledge that the murder was real because people aren't real to them, in my opinion.
Yeah. You know, even in terms of biopics, one of the most self-ingratiating biopics ever, especially in the music world, is Straight Outta Compton, which, if it feels like three different biopics for Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, and Eazy-E, all mysteries about that are dispelled when the movie's done and you see executive producers, Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, and Eazy-E's widow, which was the only way that they were going to ever make that movie with the kind of music that they needed to have the rights to. But even that movie, which almost entirely writes out the fact that there were other people in NWA, which is the music group that they are theoretically supposed to be a part of, they at least have cameos in like a few scenes. So it's like, okay, look, they weren't trying to totally just erase them from the historical record. They, you know, it's just, they wanted to basically do an Eazy-E, Ice Cube, and Dr. Dre biopic.
Six Von Erich brothers. Young one died. He got electrocuted, and then there were five. But then for the movie, they made four. And again, I'm not trying to litigate why they did it, but I said the explanation I got for the reason for that frustrated. And so when you talk about what's okay for historical stuff, I think that consolidating characters can certainly be convenient, but often sometimes people aren't doing it from a writing point of view. They're coming from a production point of view, and we're trying to do that. But I do think that every time you do that, you're telling a different story.
I'm a hard no on consolidating characters. Yeah. Like I think for you know, anything that we've done, Brian and I that to me is a line in the sand that I'm not going to cross.
Well,
like, our show is something that we want people to have the ability for. Now, where we put the focus and if a character's mm-hmm. kind of a little bit more in the vignette as opposed to in the center of the story, like that I think is 100%. Fine. Yeah.
Well, I agree that we won't do it ourselves, but I didn't hate it in Chernobyl because all the characters were one for one, except for there was one character and they owned it at the end. They in the credits said this character was a composite of the hundreds of scientists that that chimed in here or there. I thought it worked in that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say that. Given how critical people have been of the accuracy of Chernobyl from the science and everything else like that too, though, it's what's one more work of fiction if they're fictionalizing how radiation works. So I enjoyed Chernobyl. I enjoyed it very much. And then I read like, hey, you know, radiation doesn't work like this. You know, this is actually what happened. You know, this. I'm like, oh, so I basically just watched a movie that has the same name as Chernobyl, but wasn't about what happened there.
Like most of the set pieces, they were running around and doing stuff that you wouldn't need to do or they didn't do?
Like, you know, the idea that you're going to get radiated from a person in the hospital, a lot of the other things, the death rate, some of the other lot. There was when they controlled stuff, what the chances were, this were what they actually knew at the time. Again, great television. But also I would say that it did reinforce sort of a lot of the fears in nuclear energy, but by saying things that simply weren't true about way nuclear energy works. And I'm not qualified to go and take it apart. So I'll just say that right now. I liked it as a movie. I would say do your own research though. I don't want anybody to dismiss it, but it was a thing I get too, because it's hard to know. Cause too, it's like behind the Iron Curtain, what really happened? Who said what? Yeah. And that's the thing too is, I think that, you know, if you were trying to tell the story of like, by the way, German intelligence agencies are apparently now admitting COVID was probably a lab leak, you know, trying to go back and tell that story would be hard because one, the original Chinese researcher who said, hey, I think we have a problem with this thing. I think it's spreading really quickly, who then got COVID and died. You know, there are people, players, we don't know who they are. And so I think often when there's certain, we know who he is, but like, you know, patient, we forget like the actual person we think is patient zero who worked at the lab. You know, this stuff gets obfuscated and you do have the problem of sort of saying, okay, well, I'll buy this newer narrative, but maybe that newer narrative isn't as accurate either.
Yeah.
Speaking of GPT-4, I was wondering whether or not what the answer on where did COVID originate is in there. So I asked it, and it has two theories, but it does not pick between the two of them, which I think is probably the safest way that you can answer that fairly.
Yeah, it's fair. I think it's fair. I think it's, and you know, like better than like how Wikipedia handles it right now, where they want to link you to, you know, COVID conspiracy theory stuff, and it's like. Like, yeah. No, lab leak is actually the prevailing likely theory now among.
Yeah, lab leak, not plandemic. It is not. It is not like, you know, that video. You know, there are serious, rigorous, you know, questions that need to be asked about exactly what was happening. And by the way, what is still happening? That's the other fun part about the lab leak theory is what is currently happening in the Wuhan lab.
All right, how much were you ready for this? There's a paper that just came out, and I am not an expert on this. We've known historically there have been a number of examples of we've had other epidemics that were caused by lab leaks. That is not a conspiracy theory. This is a documented thing. It's accepted, and there may have been historical things of like the Russian flu and stuff. Was basically looked at the same back like 1971, there was an outbreak. It was the exact same genome as something from like 10 years earlier, which is mathematically impossible unless you pulled this thing out of a test tube and it leaked. And we've had multiple cases of these things. And there is some question of whether or not the latest strain of bird flu may have been.
Oh, no. Oh no. That's this is a sequel I don't want. How do I cancel my subscription?
Where we need like a sleuth. We need somebody on the case with this. We need somebody out there, like we need a vigilante, we need a lab leak vigilante to just like be throwing this stuff up. You know, onto the public square, because, you know, I was 5 years, there's been a lot of people online that are posting, this is the 5 year anniversary of the initial lockdowns in California and stuff like that. And so a lot of people are remembering where they were when stuff was happening, and very traumatic time for my life, very much changed the trajectory of my existence as it found out, as you know. Back then, it was just me and my wife living, you know, in Oakland in a one bedroom apartment, and now we sit in a five bedroom house with a child. But like, I've always come away the saddest from the fact that we never really were asking the kind of questions that needed to be asked, and it became so defensive to talk about like, you know, the aerosolized nature of the virus or where it came from. And like, that's the one thing I would hope. I don't know if it happens quickly or with a lot of as much contrition as others would like, but I would just hope that the curiosity for like, hey, we should know where this stuff comes from, and we should be unflinchingly rigorous about it.
The problem, there's a several-fold problem, and we've had this is a pattern. It really hasn't been discussed much, but it's happened multiple times. When somebody was sending anthrax to some people, they brought in an expert to go try to figure out who could have done this. And it pretty became clear the most likely suspect was the expert. You know, when the FBI was trying to get to the bottom of, you know, who was a Russian mole, you know, they put their top guy in the field, who's the biggest expert on Russia and American spies and stuff. Then, man, he can't find a spy for years. Can't find him forever. Turned out he was the spy. And you get
he found him in the mirror every morning.
Yeah, the more, and that was God, that was a great it was a great movie with Ryan Felipe and Chris Cooper. What was the name of that movie? But anyhow, the problem often is that there's a very narrow amount of expertise. And if I'm going to ask for experts on gain of the movie is called Breach, by the way, Ryan Felipe and Chris Cooper, but great movie about the topic about highly fictionalized, I'm sure you should be warned, but anyhow, you have a narrow group of experts. So we had the correspondence between Anthony Fauci and the other researchers when this thing first came out. And there was emails where they talked about, hey, this could be a lab leak. This could be pretty bad. We need to look into this. 2 days later, the email's like, we need to gather around that's, you know, natural origin. We need to get around the idea it was like wet market or whatever. We need to get around natural origins. This, you know, zoonotic. We don't know what happened in those couple days that made them go from, hey, there could be this and this to now. And, you know, the some would claim, well, if you looked back at where the funding was coming from, and we do know that we'd funded Wuhan, we'd funded labs around the world, that we'd to skirt bans on gain of function research in the United States. We funded it elsewhere. We also know that some of the labs we funded had terrible records for reputations for, you know, that. And, you know, there is the theory that that was covering their own asses, that literally they realized, hey, we may have inadvertently caused this thing. And there I argue like, well, do we need to focus on the, can I get this today? Like, do we need to really worry about the origins of it? 1,000%. Using another example, if a radioactive cloud drifted over Europe, yes, take cover. Do you then go, okay, that's solved? Do we need to worry about the origin of the radioactive cloud? Yes. Because it could happen again and again and again. And that's the thing that I get frustrated because I encounter this all the time. Like, what difference? Had we known what we know now, likelihood of a lab leak, we would have known that the shelter in place, all this sort of stuff was not going to work because this was engineered to spread fast through people.
Yeah.
That it did not have, it was engineered for virility and whatever, which meant that all that was stupid.
Tell me more about that. I hadn't heard about the specifically engineered to like this was like engineered as a weapon or
not that, although the lab was run by, you know, the Chinese army, but that's
yeah, there are certain things that the Chinese military might have had eyes on it for certain things, but we don't believe that the development of it was specifically as a weapon.
I believe it was sincerely developed because the challenge is this, and this is, you know, we read the books in the 90s about pandemics. You read the book about all this sort of stuff and you get terrified. What happens if Ebola gets loose, whatever. And, you know, the theory is like, hey, if the only time we get to study these fast moving viruses that, you know, is whenever we encounter one in the wild, that we may not be prepared for it. We may not understand how we're supposed to treat it, what we're supposed to do with it.
Got it.
So if we can go into a completely safe environment and create viruses that have a higher rate of infectiousness than other viruses, we can measure this, we can see this, and we can try to figure out how to mitigate it. That's the rationale behind doing it, which on that surface, I don't disagree with it. If this was the Andromeda strain and they were doing this 40 miles below the New Mexico desert, and, you know, you remember the movie Andromeda Strain?
Oh, sure, sure. Go, yeah, yeah, you know, Michael Crichton.
If that was the way it was done and not a sloppy, you know, biosafety lab level 2, they were telling was a 3 that wasn't even, there is no independent accreditation of these things, by the way. I had an argument shortly afterwards. Somebody said, oh, well, my uncle's an expert in this. And he told me that there's no way it'd get out of BLS-3. I'm like, how do you know it was a BLS? How do you know that somebody didn't prop the door open, you know, with a shoe? Like, you don't know. And it was just these people who are like looking at the literal things on the page. So
One quick note on that. I have noticed that where there are systems, a lot of things get reduced down to checkboxes, and it's tempting to believe all those checkboxes are, you know, binary, like one unit of best practices, security, the end. And it's like, of course in a million little ways, everything from, you know, a door lingering open a little bit too long, just one ride along through one door. I mean, obviously that matters. I've been thinking a lot about my inherent aversion to highly structured systems like that.
Well, yeah, the problem is, and you hit the nail on the head, is that you can say there's a checklist, but you talk to anybody that's worked in a lab, they will tell you numerous occasions, things get loose, things get, you know, measures are cut short, and happens. We only find out about the things that get discovered, or, you know, people tell us about when it comes to like lab leaks and stuff like that. You know, we don't know how many times somebody, you know, found out there was a hole in their glove or whatever, or forgot to put a vent on. You don't know this, you know, like, because everybody is human. And, you know, so yeah, it is the saying there's a procedure isn't the same as the procedure being followed. So anyhow, welcome.
Yeah. And the other side to me was that it's like, look, obviously everything that Andrew said, I think is totally 100% correct. The other thing is, when something goes wrong, we just kind of need transparency. And that was very, very disappointing on not only from people that you would not particularly expect transparency from, like the Chinese government, but also places that we do very much expect transparency from, like the United States government.
China's going to be China. You know, I get that. And a lot of people are like, oh, see, I'm like, I'm not talking about the Chinese component. I'm talking about like our, like when we did the Freedom of Information, you know, the Eco Health Alliance, which was, you know, the grant makers for this, who now has been blocked from federal grants because they refused to disclose certain information. When you look, as I understand it, you know, when you look at some of the Freedom of Information Acts, when we ask for documents and everything's redacted, like everything's been redacted from that. And it's just that's the problem, is the people we're asking to look into this don't want to look into it. Either because they're afraid of how it might be them, or, and most of them are people who trust those people and say, no, so-and-so wouldn't lie to me. So-and-so sincere. They're a stand-up guy. And I think they probably are. But then I think that then they're in a situation where you're like, you know, if there's a high probability that, you know, you may have, you know, enabled a, you know, disaster scenario that killed millions of people, not by intentional effort, by a whoopsie, how hard are you going to be to uncover that and find out your likelihood that you're, if people are willing to be distracted by some other explanation?
Oh man. What do you,
you know, who's not distracted by
who's that, Andrew?
Our audience, Justin, our wonderful, wonderful audience.
Indeed. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you need to go. If you want to support this show, we very much appreciate it. Thank you. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
So 2 years ago, GPT-4 came out, kind of changed everything.
Yeah.
Now we're moving to other areas. You guys remember we talked about Colosso Biosciences?
I do vaguely remember it.
They're working on de-extinction, guys. They're the ones that want to basically figure out how to bring back animals that are longer here, like woolly mice.
Is this woolly mice?
Woolly mice.
See this, Bri?
No. Let me get my doc open so I can show everyone at home.
The first step to woolly mammoth.
So I do know mice. that part of the journey of woolly mammoths. First of all, I'll try to give the shortest for the new listeners. We've talked previously about the fact that woolly mammoth and megafauna writ large in North America had a niche, but they were hunted to extinction. And there's a good case to be made that we should have megafauna because obviously they were there for a reason. And so we have, because woolly mammoth didn't die too long ago, we've got the DNA, or we have a lot of fairly well-preserved DNA here and there. And so the idea is to essentially create a elephant hybrid with a bunch of woolly mammoth DNA and keep on putting woolly mammoth DNA generation after generation till we pretty much have woolly mammoths, and then let them go bake in the sun because the climate changed. But have them kind of running around North America. And so I guess just like you have to crawl before you walk, I assume you have to squeak before you trumpet.
Yeah. And so what they're trying to do is, instead of like inserting woolly mammoth genes, they've looked at the woolly mammoth, they look at the mice, and you find out that, you know, that, as you know, famously, you know, we share 99% of our genes with chimpanzees. We also share like 40% of our genes with the carrot, you know? And so the difference between a lot of what an animal can often be just switching on certain genes or switching on a gene or whatever. And sometimes you introduce things to continue to grow. So they went to the mice, they used CRISPR, which lets you do precise gene editing. They basically changed some genes within the mice that changed the way the hair coat grow. And they gave the mice a very thick furry coat. They didn't actually put mammoth genes in there, but they found similar genes to a mammoth and said, okay, let's switch these on or turn on the furry coat option. And the mice now have furry coats, and they're going to be curious to see if that makes them better at being cold adapted. Because in theory, you could just take some elephants and maybe switch a couple genes and make some hairy elephants, which to me, to my eyes, would be a mammoth. I would be wrong. But to my eyes.
Well, sure. Yeah. And I think that was one of the points in, I think it was Jurassic Park, The Lost World, the book written by Michael Crichton. You know, somebody brings up, but is it really a dinosaur? And Michael Crichton, you know, within the confines of the book, essentially screams at this fan, does it matter? They're giant. Like, there was a discussion in, I'm talking about the book, not the movie, about whether they would create another island that would be more classic dinosaur. Like, hey man, if you want them slow and cold-blooded and stupid and blah blah blah, we can cook those up too, whatever you want.
Yeah, there's another thing too. I'm going to show this is my favorite, one of my favorite images from biology. Hold on one second. Talk amongst yourself.
Okay. I could talk amongst myself.
Yeah, me too. I can talk amongst Brian.
Yes, I speak Brian.
Yes, I'm sitting in the studio right now. I wonder what my wife Bonnie is cooking for dinner. I'm speaking amongst Brian.
Yeah, this is another victory point for video over audio. Nobody knows what's funny right now.
If I were to ask you how far apart in evolution are these two animals?
Oh man. I mean, they do have the exact same shaped snout and they are pretty different from each other. The one on the left has massive, massive eye sockets, which leads me to believe that that would have been much more prehistoric when there was more oxygen in the atmosphere. I'm totally.
These are both. I'm going to tell you. Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to make more precise. These skulls are both approximately around the same age.
Oh, okay.
My question is, how far apart did these species diverge?
Oh, geez. Okay. So I'm of two minds. On the one hand, I know that we share 99 point something percent DNA with the chimpanzee, but I also, and we're obviously we're genetically similar, but very, very different in our phenotypes. But I also know that there are certain niches that, you know, even if it's a totally different genetic branch, you get, for example, marsupials instead of mammals in Australia. So the question is how genetically different. I'm going to say they're surprisingly genetically different. That's my take.
So based upon probably, you know, we did preload this. So Brian, you and I are closer to the skull on the right than these skulls are to each other.
Whoa. Okay. So I'm going to guess one is a mammal and the other's not a mammal.
Well, both phyla. One's a marsupial. So marsupial mammal is a thylacine.
Okay.
So that is a Tasmanian wolf, which died out about 150 years ago. Okay. The other one is like a wolf skull or dog skull.
Hmm.
And we're looking at, they diverged about 160 million years ago, like genetically, like every mammal from whales to chimpanzees. You know, you and I are closer to a whale than either of these things are to each other, as far as genetic ancestry.
That's
that a fat joke.
That's right. Yes, it was.
You want it to be. So you think about that. Like literally, there's 160 million year gulf. So we're looking at if you handed me this skull, one of these skulls, and said I looked at it, and tomorrow I said, oh, I want you to know something else about the skull. I would not know that I looked at two different skulls, right? I would not be aware of the fact that you'd done a switcheroo on me because they're obviously to an anatomist, you know, to biologist, zoologist, they look very different, but to us, very, very similar. And so if you go look at the thylacine, like the Tasmanian wolf or the thylacine dog, and you look at that and you see, like you look at the videos of the last or the films of the last Tasmanian wolf, you know, it's walking around and you think it's a dog. Well, it's a dog. It's a dog. It's like that thing ain't, you know, you are closer to a bat than that thing is to a dog, which is crazy to think about. But they fit, like you said, that evolutionary niche. So what I'm making a case for, like what, you know, the colossal biosciences is doing is like, yeah, I don't need to recreate the entire mammoth DNA. I do need to be what I might be missing. I need to take an elephant, make it a furrier, maybe adjust some stomach enzymes and some things like this, like that. But yeah, to have a thing that's a giant, you know, animal that can walk around the tundra and stuff. Yeah, it doesn't have to be a copy of a woolly mammoth because tons of things can fill that niche and look very similar.
Yeah, and I'm here for it. Have we heard anything about the timeline that they're operating on? I mean, obviously, you know, everything's super experimental at this phase.
Yeah, they've said things, but I don't know how much, you know, I would.
I'm saying speed it up.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Let's go. It.
Let's just go. I need woolly mammoths.
Which do you think will happen?
Desk EOD next week.
Which do you think will happen first? A close enough woolly mammoth genetically made out of organic material, or somebody crafting a synthetic and just setting it loose in the wild? Basically, hey, your job is to, instead of eating trees, you're going to solar charge and pick up trash. Go.
I would say organic.
Yeah? I don't know. I might lean towards robotic.
Yeah, but if you're going to go through the trouble building a robot to do it, then just why not build something that looks like a combine?
Well, probably because
like a combine.
Well, yeah, because you would be building it so it could be in a. I mean, you would want to be representing a woolly mammoth, so it'd essentially be like a theme park attraction.
Yeah, but you're talking about an area of hundreds of thousands of miles. Do I need them all to look like woolly mammoth? And the chance that one tourist strays into this area, or am I just going to bring William? I would just.
I would say that in the fundraising phase, humans are going to vote for the thing that looks like an homage to a species that humans drove to extinction, and that there'll be a survivorship bias for any proposal that has them look like woolly mammoths instead of a combine.
Yeah, but they're like, it's a robot woolly mammoth. People would be going, okay, why are we paying $800 billion for this? When I could just pay $40 million to do the job, and you're like, well, because you can go look at it. I'd be like, well, I guess
a short response would be for the same reason that we make cell phone towers look like palm trees. Like technically, there's no reason to do that.
Because the reason we do that is because we see them all the time. We don't make cell phone towers in the middle of nowhere look like palm trees.
Oh, well, you know, in my example, I said they would go around and pick up trash. So.
If you're saying that I 100%, like, let me clear, like, if you're saying like, oh, near the touristy parts of Yellowstone, you know, we'll put in some robot things, but you know, robot bison that won't actually kill you and stuff, which again, there'd be a problem. They're like, no, we need people to know how to kill them. Like, yeah, like I could see like there, but if you're talking about the hundreds of thousands of square miles of which they want to put these thing in there, you know, to have some part remote region of Alaska where nobody, you know, two people set foot in, why would you put a big robot there?
In state parks, we're going to put in a robotic Yogi Bear, but instead of picnic baskets, he takes trash.
Yes. And let me make it very clear. It has been pointed out multiple times to me. I say things where I sound like I have complete conviction, but I want to remind everybody, we're talking about robot woolly mammoths.
Yeah, no,
we're so back. We're so back. We're so back talking about robot woolly mammoths. Let's go. Let's go.
I would point out that I don't know that a combine would save you very much money over a woolly mammoth. Like when it comes to artistic design, you know, and it'll probably be the synths would be assembled by robots. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to say that that the iteration process for synthetic woolly mammoths is going to be much faster than the genetic iteration on that. I'm voting synthetic.
You mean robotic?
Yeah. I'm saying.
The question is going to come into it because the argument's being made. There's a naturalist that we want to return this to a natural environment. And if you're like, yes, and I'm going to put a bunch of robots out there.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, in Kim Stanley Robinson's series, as they terraform Mars, in the economy that he speculates could exist, there's a place for what they call eco-poets, where it's like, my job is to see if I can do this, and let's see. And as we get closer and closer to, and I'm hypothesizing here, a constraint-free economy, then there'll be more places like, hey, so-and-so billionaire has this many 100,000 acres of whatever. I'm announcing my project is to see if we can recreate what it looked like, let's say 20,000 years ago or whatever. And then at that point, if there's and of course we need a megafauna to fill that niche. And then the question is, how are we doing with, what was it, colossal, How is your woolly mammoth coming along? And it's like, let's just throw a robot in there to occupy that niche.
I hear you, even though you're quoting a socialist science fiction writer. It's
who later recanted on any chance of Mars being terraformable.
What's that?
Kim Stanley Robinson is bearish on us ever staying on Mars for any amount of time.
I think we'll stay. My argument for why we could stay on Mars is like, listen, there's probably a million people in airplanes right now over our heads.
Yeah.
Like we are very good at the one thing in human history is we're very good at saying, you can't live there. No way you can do that. Watch me. And we have cruise ship industries and airlines and people in Antarctica. We figure it out. Like I'm not worried about that. I don't know about terraforming though, because I don't know that how do we, I think terraforming will come somewhere around the same time as we get high speed rail in California.
Oh, damn. Deep cut.
And the high speed rail is just because by the time you get that much sign on and you've had this many grifters that come into the program to take money out of it and to literally you spend billions on all these corrupt contracting and whatever goes on and all this craft, there's nothing left to build the rail with. Everybody, if we could snap our fingers and have it overnight, the same with terraforming Mars, like terraforming Mars will just never happen. Not because we technically can't.
We can't all, everybody, one line. We got to work together. Guys, get over here. Pee break.
The lawsuits, we will be building orbital habitats in trans, visiting other stars, while it's still working its way through courts. I kid you not. That is my belief. And,
on that note, I do have to return to childcare, boys. So I'm going to make my pick right now. And it's dedicated to a longtime Weird Things listener by the name of Carson Pace.
Ooh.
Whose band, the Callous Dowboys, has a new single out today called Lemon. If you have ever heard the Callous Dowboys, if you're into heavy rock music, mathcore, as they call it, then you will enjoy it. But it's not for everybody's taste. There's a lot of really loud noises and a lot of screaming and a lot of stuff like that. But the new single Lemon is unlike anything that they have done. I'm very, very proud of Carson. They're on tour currently in Europe. And I would encourage everybody to go give it a listen. Lemon off their brand new album, I Don't Want to See You in Heaven, that comes out in May. It may or may not have a familiar voice in the intro and outro.
Oh.
We'll see. We'll see. Anyway, see you later, boys.
See ya. Dude, that's awesome.
That's cool. My pick. Well, Brian, you go with your pick. Sorry.
You know what? I'm making my way through The Master Algorithm. Came out in 2015. Fancy pants folks. I think it was Bill Gates mentioned the book alongside Nick Bostrom's Superintelligence in 2016. Have you read The Master Algorithm?
I had it. I read a little bit of it, and then I would say that he and I have very different takes upon the path of AI. And I would say that not only would he have said we won't get to where we are now, he doesn't agree with where we are right now.
Well, it's interesting because it's riding the line between profound and high thoughts right now for me. I'm about maybe 40% of the way through it, but it's like it's interesting because like the overall thesis appears to be there are certain formulas that are just true, full stop, and they're true throughout the universe. Force equals mass times acceleration, etc. And a thing that has mass and a thing that is in motion, when mass is in motion, it has, you know, it makes an impact. What is that impact is, you know, that's the algorithm for it. And the question is, what else seems to also have those kind of hard laws? There are certain laws of human behavior in group dynamics and crowds that you know, you could take, for example, this example is not in the book, but it's one that pops to mind. When you hear about people getting crushed at a concert, it's because in that crowd, they're moving approximately akin to a liquid. The crowd of people behaves exactly as the molecules inside of a liquid was. And sometimes there's dynamics that are unstoppable. So it's like, even though in theory, everyone could just decide to stop crushing each other, they literally can't. So anyway, the point is, what rules-based things can be applied to novel other places? And sometimes there are some really interesting surprises. Other times it's like, yeah, I guess kind of everything is like a sine wave, you know, but I'm digging it. It's got me, I'm only doing it in pieces.
Yeah. I'm glad you're enjoying it. I would say that I'm familiar with some of his comments on some of the AI stuff and all that. And I had a book and part of, I would say that like there, I have this sort of feeling like reading a book about AI can be in some ways written before, let's say, 2021 or 2022, depending on who wrote it, can be a lot like reading a book about physics prior to like 1903.
Yeah.
Like there's this thing where you have, there are things we know that are true. And yeah. Like, nope. Things were not true at all. We found out this, whatever. And so I'm glad. I think this stuff, I'll be on that. Sounds great.
And to be honest, I don't, as long as you know that you're getting into that, I kind of don't mind those historical artifacts. For example, there's one book that is incredibly valuable to me. The Origin of Brands talks about how they make the bold claim that outside of the clock radio, no thing has been two things combined and been successful. That was hyperbole, of course. But as they go on to declare, in general, we like our things to be the one thing. Whenever you try to mash a whole bunch in with a Swiss Army knife kind of thing, then in the mind, it's too many things to keep track of. Like, like a flying car, you know, a car that you can attach wings to and fly or whatever. Any combo thing tends to do poorly in the marketplace of ideas. And, as they're describing it, they're describing all the communications devices from the early aughts that were, it's a pager with also a keyboard and you can make phone calls on it. And you could tell that this was written just before the iPhone. And so at the time it was kind of eye rolling, like, well, clearly they're so wrong. The iPhone is the best thing ever. But reading it now with that in mind, it's like, nope, they're 100% right. What felt like them being wrong was the emergence of a brand new category of what we now think of as a smartphone. We just didn't have the word for it at the time. So instead, like, the iPhone was literally announced as three different devices combined into one. But really, now we think of it as just the one device. It was the pioneer of a new category.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I sometimes find it helpful to kind of go back for like two decades or three decades before an era, because then we weren't you know, kind of nearsighted by things. Like if you're talking about AI development, if you weren't paying attention in like 2020, I mean, if GPT-2, like I just, to me, that was where the signal was there. And I kind of find it inexcusable. Sometimes people are like,
by the way, that's very, your dance around it. I literally was not paying attention. And you and me and Justin all got the same demo, but of the three of us, only one of us were like, this is the biggest thing in the world.
Yeah, well, but when GPT-2 came out, you know, remember I was excited and I read every single thing that came on GitHub. And so when I got the call for GPT-3, I'm like, I've been waiting for your call. Let me tell you what I think is really cool. And what I found out by looking at, like, because when GPT-2 came out, we talked about it. I just went and read every single output they published to understand what the thing was doing outside of just the mathematics on the paper. And that was when I had this sort of like, oh, you know, like if this scales. This will be a thing. And then I get a call from GPT-3 and I'm like, oh, it scaled. And so, yeah, but again, I mean, people in AI and stuff like we're talking about woolly mammoth mice. We've got a lot of things on our plate here.
Yep.
But I think that my thing is the people who are in tech or particularly in AI who are still like, again, there's a person who's, you know, a famous, you know, noted critic who's kind of a joke at this point, who had an article in Wired that says, you know, language models won't be able to do these things. And literally GPT-3 at the time could do that, but it hadn't been released. And then finally, the first thing I did with GPT-3 was I went through every single example and is what it can't do. And it did all of them. And they've never acknowledged that they were wrong. They've never said no. They just keep, you know, moving the goalposts, so to speak.
That's amazing. What about you? What do you got?
Goodness. So, you know what? The wife and I, we want to watch the new Daredevil Born Again, but she never watched the original Daredevil Netflix series.
Oh,
and I'm like, oh, let's go watch that.
Does Brian? It stand up?
Oh yes.
Yeah. I bet so. It's great.
It is. It especially stands up. And I'm not trying to judge it by how awful Marvel content has been of late. But it's, yeah, it was really, I go back and I'm like, oh yeah. Like the way they introduced, you know, Matt Murdock, the way they introduced the characters, I like all the characters, Wilson Fisk, the way they introduce him.
Oh, you know what? And yeah. I'll tell you, I don't normally do this, but I think we got to wrap it up. I got an important call.
Later.
All right.
It's been weird.
Bye guys. All right, I have to put on my Superman outfit. Audio listeners, I hope you enjoyed that extra silence. Bye, guys.